Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political, and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Sunday session on Should We Leave the European Convention on Human Rights, a subject which, of course, is making its way up the political agenda at the moment. So to discuss this topical issue, we have five speakers, and I should have said, by the way, I'm John Holbrook, and I'm chairing this session. And we've got five speakers who I'm going to introduce in the order in which they're going to speak. First off is going to be John Oxley. John is a political commentator and consultant who writes for a range of publications, including The New Statesman, The Spectator, and Unheard. He has a Substack, Joxley Writes, that's W-R-I-T-E-S, and it's become one of the most influential and well-read blogs on the right of British politics. In an earlier life, John practiced family law as a barrister. Our second speaker will be Stephen Barrett, on my left. Stephen is an experienced barrister, practicing in commercial law, but he has a broad interest in law of all descriptions. And in 2019, he became the writer on law for The Spectator magazine. Stephen is particularly interested in the division between law and politics and in where and how that line should be drawn. Then our third speaker on my right will be Jamie Burton. Jamie is a barrister and social justice campaigner. He has a strong reputation for using the law in a pioneering way to tackle poverty and discrimination. Jamie is the co-founder of Just Fair, an NGO he chairs and represents at the United Nations. Just Fair argues for economic, social, and cultural rights. And then we're going to hear from Angelica Walker-Worth. Angel is an assistant editor and writer for The Objective Standard. She is also a fellow and programs manager at Objective Standard Institute, where she has responsibilities for, among other things, course administration and development and event organisation. She is also an Ayn Rand Fellow. I think I've mispronounced that.
Ayn Rand.
Thanks. And then our final speaker is going to be Luke Gittos. Luke is a solicitor practising in criminal law. He is also director of the Freedom Law Clinic and legal editor for the online magazine Spiked. His most recent book, Human Rights, Illusory Freedom, was published in 2019 by Zero Books. So can we please welcome our five speakers? And you're probably now all familiar with the format of these discussions. Well, if you came yesterday, you would be. And that is that I'm going to ask each speaker to make their introductory remarks for no more than 6 minutes. And after they've each done that, then I'm going to open the discussion up to the floor. So, John, could you kick us off, please?
Thank you, John. My starting point is that I do not trust government, and I do not trust governments. In particular, I don't trust them to tell the truth, and even more so, I don't trust them to respect the rights and freedoms of small groups of individuals when those people get in their way in pretty much any avenue of life. And I think that is well-founded by some of the things that British governments have done within living memory, and many of which have been highlighted, uncovered, and litigated through the dimension of the Convention on Human Rights and how that has been incorporated into British law through the Human Rights Act. Within living memory, British government have effectively tortured its own citizens in Northern Ireland. It has shot dead unarmed people in the street in Northern Ireland and lied about it for 30 or 40 years. At a football match in Sheffield, the negligence of the British state apparatus killed 96 people. They then lied about it for, again, about 30 years. Tony Blair's government sent British soldiers, 18, 19-year-olds, into battle with equipment that they knew was defective and inadequate. And that, again, was only contested when those parents used the Human Rights Act to take the government to court. From that, my conclusion, much like James Madison in the Federalist Papers, is that you need something in place to constrain governments, even when they're doing something popular. You need something to hit back against what he referred to as the dictatorship of the 50% plus one. And that takes us to the Convention and the Human Rights Act, and that does act in that manner today. And for me, then that leads to the question of whether the ECHR is adequate and whether undoing it would lead to something better or something worse. In politics, we often talk about slippery slopes, but something, there's a similar idea that we talk about a bit less, which is this idea of the ratchet and the lockstep. And this idea is when something is in place, you get a certain amount of inertia, like a ratchet, and it's very hard to move it. But once you do, it slides very quickly. And I think the danger with undoing the current human rights settlement is it would open up this discussion very broadly again. And I think no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, there's all sorts of dangers in that. Because one of the things we have seen over the last 70 years is all sorts of attempts to elevate things to the same level as human rights law. And if we open this debate up again, I think it is quite possible you will get legislation, particularly if this becomes a sort of ordinary piece of legislation that can be amended at will, for example, to make access to healthcare a human rights issue. You have campaigners that say housing is a human rights issue. And I think there is a real danger that repealing the Human Rights Act, withdrawing from the ECHR, would see a British Bill of Rights become something that is far broader in scope, would extend the power of the state in many regards, but would also extend the power of certain groups to fight against that. And I think one of the groups that would be losers in that, in particular, are people on the right and are people whose views are becoming increasingly unpopular. One of the landmark cases of human rights law application in Britain was about someone's right to wear a crucifix at work, a British Airways case. And I think there is a real danger amongst Conservatives that they are going to repeal the Human Rights Act and find that it doesn't act as a shield for them anymore. So starting from the position that I don't trust governments and we need to restrain them in some way, I think the Human Rights Act, as it sits now, does an adequate job, and that for many reasons, undoing that would lead to all sorts of complications and issues that would lead many of us to be worse off in terms of our political rights, and as well would leave governments in a position where it's even harder to get things done. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Stephen, your thoughts, please.
Right. Obviously, I think that's all nonsense. Law is the process of applying a rule, and you apply it consistently, and then you move on. And I want you to imagine that like a little line. And then we come to the next factual situation, and we work out a new rule, and we have another line. And all of these branching lines create a giant tree of rules. And I shouldn't be here, because I should be in that tree. And the interesting law isn't in the middle of that tree. It's not, should we have a law against murder? Duh, obviously we do. That's not exciting law. Exciting law should be at the fringes of that concept, at the edges, at the branches, inside the very leaves of that tree, at the branching line. That's where interesting law is, and as a High Court barrister, I fought very hard to get there, that's all I should really be doing. But I've been dragged into public life because in the 90s, some politicians decided that that wasn't enough. No, no, no. We would use law, they said, to protect everybody, to make everybody free. And who do they by the way, they want to protect everybody from you. There is this great fear of the public. There is a great fear of democracy. And that's what they've done with human rights. They've dragged it right back to the center of that tree, right back to basic principles. They've got 46 people in an office block in Strasbourg. Each of them, by the way, only grew up inside their own tree. So there's 46 different trees. If you're with me on this slightly tortured metaphor, I belong to the English and Wales tree, and that's my tree, and I think I'm quite good at it, and if you watch me on television, I'll be quite broad in it. I won't go into tax law. That's a bit of the tree I'm not going into. It's just way too scary for me. But imagine me then, what do I do? Imagine I'm promoted to this thing. Imagine I go over to Strasbourg and I sit in the office block, and now I'm deciding on how the Icelandic tree should work. I'm deciding how a Polish family should function. Am I? I don't know anything about Poland. Why on earth would I be the person to make that decision? Why on earth would these 46 people, and I think it's tortured logic to call them judges because they're not. I think it's tortured logic to call this a court because it's not doing that process of applying rules consistently. It's going back to basic principles and it's making it up based on what they all think. And it's a political club. They're only letting in people who already think the things that they all think. So it's a fixed type of politics, which, by the way, I try to stay non-political. But if you try and fix one type of politics forever, you will break your society because things change, times change, attitudes change, ideas change. This institution is rapidly becoming obsolete because it is the 90s made flesh. It's just re-watching episodes of Friends. I mean, that's all it's doing. You need to think again on why we have this thing. Is it any use at all? If you believe in human rights and fundamental rights, fine. We gave them the list, okay? And I get a bit irritated at the confusion. ECHR, let's use that to mean the convention. ECTHR, let's use that to mean the court. Let's get rid of the court. That's the real problem. The convention's not an issue. It's already fundamental principles of English law. We just, after the Second World War, we wrote, oh, what are the basic principles of English law? We should really have actually asked the newly freed countries of Europe to adopt English law. I think that would have been a much better solution. But there was no way in hell the Americans were going to let that happen. So instead they said, oh, well, just give us the basic principles of English law. Don't have the detail. They can go back to the Napoleonic law, which, by the way, is rubbish. There is a marketplace for law. I want people to know that. So I'm an international lawyer and I practice in international private law. That's the bit of international law that works. And it's very popular. It's a way that businessmen can do trade across the globe and have confidence and faith that the agreements will be kept and that everything will function. And we use a system called international arbitration to do that. And when you use this system called international arbitration, you're allowed to pick which type of law you use. And there are two types of law that everybody always picks. If it's a highly contested political or geopolitical issue, they will pick American law because it's better to be with the Americans. If it's not political, if it's not going to be contentious and they just want good law, they'll pick English law. So we have a very good legal system. We don't need 46 people, 45 of whom did not grow up inside our tree, to tell us how our tree should function at basic levels. We don't need it. It doesn't function. Oh, and by the way, the last point I want to make, it doesn't work. And this is a really awful point, because I now have to point out things which are horrible. But John gave you a long list of awful things that happened whilst we were in the convention. So it doesn't work. We just had a state which has a brilliantly written codified constitution, which has human rights law absolutely riven through its law and its constitution, and it, in theory that would be great, but it just invaded Ukraine. So this stuff doesn't work. This is a 1990s idea by a legal philosopher called Ronnie Dworkin that judges are Hercules, that judges are superheroes, that judges will solve all the problems. I used to think that when I was a young man, because I was first in my family to go to university, very respectful of law, I enjoy law, and the judges therefore must be heroes. The one thing that proved to me that judges are not superheroes was meeting the judges. So can we please all just pull back from this idea that judges will solve all of your political problems, that judges will solve you from the ignominy of losing an election, oh dear, how terrible, and waiting 4 years or 5 years until your team wins again, which is basically all this is. It's just entrenchment. It's just cheap politics. It doesn't help law. It's not really doing law. It makes a mockery of law. We have the best legal system. We have the best judges. Let them just do law. Let us all come out of this nightmare of thinking that we're superheroes. Thank you very much.
Jamie.
Thanks very much. Always be wary of the zealot convert, I'm afraid, because Stephen just talked a pile of nonsense. I'm really sorry. And I can't even work out what the point was. I mean, fundamentally, nobody believes judges are superhuman. Nobody's giving judges this huge amount of power over our lives. It's absolute nonsense. There's no evidence to back it up. Look for some examples. You won't find any. What the courts do in the context of rights is evaluate some principles by reference to other principles based on the evidence. That's all they do. And what we've seen consistently from our courts and indeed from Strasbourg is the invocation of a key principle called the margin of appreciation, right? Which is where the courts openly and legitimately say we will only interfere at the margins if we consider the political position to have become untenable. And that's really John's point. It's where the majoritarian rule has been shown to be disproportionate by placing a disproportionate burden on a minority. That's it, right? It's nothing more than that. Judges aren't dictating the rules in this country. It's not a political fantasy that anybody's serious about. But there are some very serious issues that are part of this debate that I think we do need to keep in mind. And I just want to raise a couple of them. I appreciate that not all of them necessarily will be ones you agree with, but let's at least discuss them and have a serious conversation about a very, very serious topic. So the first point I wanted to make is, you know, let's just recognise how radical a proposition this is, which is not a reason not to do it. I fully accept that, but let's understand how radical it is. We would be the first country to leave the European Convention on Human Rights voluntarily. The only other countries that have left have been ejected because they haven't complied with the judgments. The second point is, if you go so far as to say that we need to leave the European Convention, just as John has already pointed out, what are we replacing it with? And I think that's a really, really important point. Do we want to be the only country, I can't find any other than Saudi Arabia and Brunei, who don't purport to respect human rights in their constitutions? Now, I'm not suggesting we'll necessarily end up there, but it is a slippery slope, and I would agree with what John said about that. I also think, you know, we need to think about our position internationally. We can't ignore it. We can't pretend we're not part of an international system of rules. Now, this is a really important point, I think, but particularly at the moment. We really need to think about, are we internationalists in the sense that do we believe in the endeavour of trying to find common standards and common values across borders, across peoples? Because to my mind, that's by definition an honourable endeavour. Nobody's obliged to do it, but shouldn't we be seeking, as best we can, where we have common agreement? Shouldn't we be seeking to have systems in place which try to prevent the worst egregious forms of bad government? Authoritarianism, totalitarianism, etc. Shouldn't we be trying to protect all people? And in order to do that, we need to find common purpose, and we need to back that up with a system of rules. It's hard to overstate the symbolic significance of Britain, of all countries, withdrawing from the international legal order, particularly at the moment. I'm sure you know what I'm referring to. And where does it stop? Do we pull out the Geneva Convention? Do we pull out of the UN? Do we pull out of these systems which are designed to try and protect all peoples? For the benefit of what? A rather parochial mindset and some sort of fantasy that we're all at the behest of 47 judges in Strasbourg. I'm going to give you some stats about Strasbourg in a moment, but I do think it's important that we all have in mind the international significance of withdrawing from the European Convention. What would be achieved? Britain has the lowest number of applications to the European Convention of Human Rights. In the year ending August 2022, there are 210 applications. 206 of those were ruled inadmissible. There was nothing of any significance meriting the European Court's review. It didn't even go to a judicial panel. So it's a tiny minority of cases, very, very small. But by definition, they might be important ones that might require the court to consider whether or not the rights of people here have been violated. But on the other side of the equation, much more important is the influence the English courts have had and continue to have on the development of the jurisprudence in the European Court. Now, if you accept my perspective about the international significance of this, why would Britain withdraw from the means by which it has its most profound impact on the development of the law, you know, internationally? It's madness. It makes no sense. It's the opposite of being proud of your legal system. It's parochialism and nothing short of that. So it wouldn't really achieve anything. And it would be a huge irony, I think, would it not, that if we ended up leaving that international arena because we have a problem about our own borders that we can't sort out,
and we're reaching for policies that don't make sense, that don't stack up, that aren't supported by the civil service, that won't save any money and won't work. And it's clear to me, just as John indicated earlier, that some politicians are now weaponizing that issue to pursue a broader attack on the European Convention and the restraints that puts on government. And we should all be very worried about that. Ultimately, despite what Stephen said, the Human Rights Act there is there to protect us against governments, fundamentally. And we should always keep that in mind before we throw it out on the basis of a small, minor issue that we should be able to tackle ourselves without any reference to other countries and outlandish policies that have no basis in evidence. So don't allow that issue to be able to destabilise an international system of rules which has otherwise worked reasonably well, even if it's imperfect.
Angel, your thoughts, please.
Thank you. So I'd like to begin by noting that I am the only one on this panel who hasn't any legal training whatsoever, so I shall leave issues of procedural matters to my esteemed fellow panelists. What I do work with is philosophy. I work at an organization that promotes philosophy for freedom and flourishing with an emphasis on morality and the history of natural rights theory. And as John has noted, rights are a key issue, the key issue here, philosophically speaking. So we need to be very clear on what exactly it is that rights are. Now, I would argue that we need to do this by reference to the facts of reality, not by reference to any document, the ECHR, the UN Declaration of Human Rights, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, or any similar document like that. We need to look at what actually is the truth of the human part of human rights. In order to do that, we need to think about what kind of being we are, what it is that makes us different from other beings, which is fundamentally that we are rational. This is, of course, not to say everyone is rational all the time. You know that's not true. But everyone is able to be rational, and that is our means of survival fundamentally. We don't have claws. We don't have sharp teeth. We're not particularly strong. We don't have particularly strong senses. But we are rational. We can use our minds to do everything from build basic tools to collaborating with each other to developing language to have conversations like this one. If that's so, then what we need fundamentally to be free is to be able to act on our rational judgment. Now, of course, we're all individuals. We disagree on this panel. Many of you may disagree with me. So what do we do in that case? We need to be able to act freely as long as my acting freely doesn't get in the way of your acting freely. For that reason, rights very clearly need to be limited to freedom of action within a social context that don't infringe on other people's rights. I'm very sensitive to John's point that we must not elevate all kinds of political agendas to the level of human rights. That confuses the issue, and it waters down what are legitimate human rights. Now, in that context, the purpose of government, the moral justification for government as such, needs to be protecting rights. A government is an agency that has a monopoly, a legal monopoly on the use of force within its territory, and that is a very serious responsibility. Again, I'm with John in not trusting the government on principle, because we have seen that they abuse that legal monopoly time and time again. The only moral case for using force is against those who have initiated its use. If we want law to protect us, we need to have it limited to that purpose, to protecting human rights. Now, in that context, I personally do not care if it is the UK government protecting rights or a different government. The purpose of the ECHR, the convention, thank you for the clarification, is to serve as a check not only to the UK government, but to any European government that is violating rights. There is a clause in there that you must first exhaust domestic remedies. You must first try within your own country. If you cannot get rights protection within your own country, then you go to the ECHR. I grant the convention is not a perfect document. It has within it clauses and exceptions that undermine its own protection. For example, it protects us against forced labor, but the military draft is not included. Is that not forced labor? It also protects against torture and a number of other things. So there are some solid protections, but there are other ways we can undermine them. If somebody wants to talk about that more later, I have a list. But it's better than saying, if you don't like rights protection in this country, then just leave. Because that's the other option, is having, if we don't can't get remedies from our government, then you must go somewhere else and there's no other choice. I'm not disagreeing that it needs reform. however, and I'm not going to get into the discussion of sovereignty versus judicial overreach. I'm not denying there probably has been judicial overreach. European courts are prone to it. And you can make that argument that in the judgment regarding Rwanda, it certainly was. But what we need to be dealing with is the protection of rights. As my fellow panelists have brought up, there have been cases brought against the UK since the adoption of the Human Rights Act, which was bringing the ECHR into British law. There have been a number of them that have been successful. There have been more successful cases against the UK, and by successful, I mean the court ruled that there was at least one breach of the convention involved in the case by the UK government. There have been more cases since the adoption of the Human Rights Act than before it. So the Human Rights Act is not sufficient to protect our rights. I think that's sufficient for me for now. I'd love to hear what Luke has to say.
Luke.
Thanks, John. For the last 60 years, two words sat at the centre of the human rights ideology and human rights jurisprudence. Does anyone care to guess what they were? The words were never again. The idea was that European and international human rights organisations had effectively legislated away the risk of another Holocaust, a risk of another mass instance of violence against a minority. I logged on to Amnesty's website in preparing for this debate, and those words were still there. They proclaimed to have made never again a reality. How wrong they were, how complacent they were, how ignorant they were. My view is that this debate that we've seen, I can't talk about the law as authoritatively as Jamie or Stephen. I'm not a human rights lawyer. I want to talk about politics, and I want to talk about the present moment, because I think my clarion call to lawyers, those who think we should leave the European Convention on Human Rights, those who think we should stay in, is wake the fuck up. Because the fights over freedom that we have today have very little to do with the European Court of Human Rights, the European Convention on Human Rights, or the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. It's worth remembering that the General Director of the UN very recently came out and said, after the October the 7th attacks, that these didn't happen in a vacuum. In other words, never again, but maybe again, if Israel continue to behave in the way that they do. Jamie talked very amicably about universal values, and I think rather than engage in a back and forth, that's the starting point that we need. But the reality is that we are further away than ever from formulating those coherent values and for standing up for a coherent set of ideas. And that is what I think makes today's situation very different to 1948, when the drafters of the European Convention met in The Hague to discuss how to bring human rights jurisprudence to Europe. These were European conservative intellectuals, people including Winston Churchill, Maxwell Fife. They all believed that there was something about European values that were worth defending. They were staunch believers that the way that they envisaged freedom was superior to that which was being expounded by Russia and the USSR. Today, we are a million miles away from believing in the values of the West or of Europe. We have experienced over the last 4 or 5 decades the gradual depletion of our respect for freedom, a complete collapse in particularly young people's belief that Western values are worth defending. You see this time and time and again in every survey that comes out around social attitudes among young people. Statistics are related to freedom of speech, statistics related to, for example, whether most recently whether Israel were in the right or in the wrong. Consistently, you see young people believing that Western values are not something to defend, but something to rally against. And that's not something that the framers of the European Convention could ever have anticipated, that in fact the values that they were seeking to instill, the values that they were seeking to enshrine, would be disregarded by the populations that they were seeking to legislate for. So in my view, the debate about the European Convention on Human Rights is fiddling while Rome burns. What we really need to start talking about is how we reinstill a political respect for individual rights and individual freedom. And I think the starting point for that has to be recognizing the urgency of the situation we are in. The political philosopher Hannah Arendt, I think, is worth revisiting at a time like this. She's often seen as a forebearer of our contemporary human rights framework. She was writing at a time when Jewish people were in diaspora across Europe in the aftermath of the First World War, and was writing in order to identify that people who are not subject to legal systems, people who exist outside the normal frameworks of law, are uniquely vulnerable, not just to state power, but to the absence of any state regulation at all. For Arendt, the diaspora across Europe represented a lacuna in the protection of civil liberty. I think we need to recognize today that that lacuna still exists, and that it needs to be filled by political communities like this who are willing to stand up for some kind of universal values. So my plea really is to lawyers like Jamie, lawyers like Stephen, to move on from this debate about the European Convention and to recognize that we are in an emergency when it comes to formulating universal values. Universalism is in crisis. We face an existential fight for the values of the West. And the more we become ingratiated in this discussion around human rights, I think more disservice we do to that debate. I want to mention very briefly one recent case that was in the European Court of Human Rights. I didn't particularly want to talk about law, but I thought it was remarkable that one of the most recent decisions of the court was in international, I'm going to mispronounce my German, so I'm afraid you'll just have to deal with it, Humanitary Hilfos Organization, look it up, versus Germany. This was a case involving the German government sanctioning of an organization connected directly with Hamas. The German government had seized the assets of this purportedly charitable organization that were distributing money and food to the families of martyrs in Gaza. But the German authorities had found that this organization was directly affiliated with Hamas. They called the organizations things like Islamic Society and Humanitarian Society, but the German government had recognized its connection to Hamas and took steps. The organization, in other words, a subsidiary of Hamas, brought a case against the German government, and this is a very recent case, and said that this was an unlawful breach of the convention. Now, the court found against the organization and in favor of the German government. But I want you to think about what might have happened if it had gone the other way. And this really gets me to the one principled argument I would make, the only argument that matters, which is an argument about democracy. At a time like this, we need democratic control over how our government behaves. We need absolute democratic control over how our government behaves. And if you believe as a principle in democracy, then we should leave the European Convention on Human Rights. I don't think, with respect, that Jamie or John believe in democracy as a principle. They believe that democracy should be curbed. They take a model from America about checks and balances, and that's a perfectly respectable belief to hold. I believe, as a principle, that we are the best people to decide how to govern in the most urgent moral questions of our time. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, panelists. I'll come out to the audience for questions, and I'll take them in batches. Just one point I would make about all the speakers, in terms of some of the questions you might like to think about, is that it seems to me they've all signed up to the notion of human rights as being a good thing, by which I mean something which is timeless and universal. I mean, Stephen was the most critical of the ECHR, but he said the problem is with the court, not with the principles in the convention itself. So some people might like to even question the far more fundamental notion of whether you can have principles which are both timeless and universal in terms of crossing borders. That was just an off-the-cuff response from me. But please do raise anything relevant to this issue. Okay, and there are microphones, so if you could go to the gentleman to your right first. And is there just the one microphone?
Yeah,
okay, thank you.
Just a very simple point, and I'm not an expert in this area, but as a very general principle, of course, the American Constitution has various principles at its heart. Arguably, and I just sort of throw this in as a debate topic, really, arguably the freedom of speech in this country is being severely clipped. Narratives are being woven by governments and by our government and by the media. People are being controlled in what they're allowed to say and to a degree to think. In America, they've got the First Amendment, I think it is, which essentially protects freedom of speech in a slightly odd way because it was the protection of the media, and ironically, the media are actually now the target of the problem. But at least it's the case that in the United States, in a kind of clunky way, it's possible for people to rise up and say, no, you can't stop us from talking freely. So I would just suggest that is an example of where a fundamental principle can, even if not perfectly, act to help protect people from imposition by government. Thank you.
Okay. And there's a couple of people down here, please, who take the lady first.
First, thank you for your valuable thoughts. I am a law student from Hungary, and my first question would be that, as I know that if judges come from different backgrounds, for example, when they are in the European Court of Human Rights, then it is a higher chance that they will be more objective because they come from different backgrounds and different values maybe they value and or think. And what guarantees that judges of the English courts will make objective decisions or not politic-based decisions? And my second question would be that how can we make more sufficient the procedure of the European Court of Human Rights? Thank you.
Thank you. If you can pass the microphone to your right, thanks.
Thank you very much.
If you could stand up.
Oh, sorry. In terms of, there's a conceptual error, I think, in pointing to individual cases or examples from the ECHR, which is that regardless of whether you agree or disagree with them, the problem is the undemocratic nature of the organisation. So there's no answer in that sense. But what we're detecting here is the sort of anger from the people who are annoyed at the idea that their views can no longer be imposed on everybody. And that is surely the real concern. And it's people who want to not only codify but rigidify those views permanently in law. That's a problem. And the extension of the ECHR over decades, particularly with Article 8 and the right to autonomy, is what has led to Lord Sumption saying it's time to leave. So it is no longer the soi-disant view universally that we stay in the ECHR. And isn't the fundamental question about accountability and democracy? And if you do not protect those two principles by insisting in accountability and democracy at a domestic level, you have lost something, and you've lost something serious.
Thank you. Can I? Yep.
My name is Ling. I'm from China, and for the past 7 years, I live in the UK. I echo what you said, that Western value is becoming worse. And I noticed, because in China, is there any way in the Western country to counterpart that? You know, in China, people don't have access to Western websites like YouTube or the social media. But then China had something they call online troops, something like that. They just send lots of maybe misinformation or to, what's the word, undermine the value, Western value. And that's one thing. And what's the, is there any strategy that Western countries defend their value? And another quick question is, a lot of people who have never been to China I met, they really have this kind of, I think they get information from the internet, thinking China is ideal. They think, oh, our government is so bad doing this and that. And I said, if you live in China, you would know, because I grew up in there. And humanity or freedom, speech, no, this the civilization way, you know, like this developing country. So I compare, I live in here, I really see what is like in China. So people who have never been there, I mean, they just have this kind of, what's the word, like thinking or fantasy or thinking China is much better. And so, I mean, is there a way to help people understand that? Thank you.
Okay, if you could take it to the gentleman here. And then we'll take you next.
Thank you very much. I find myself extremely torn on this question. Ideally, what I would like to do is to find a way of throwing out the bathwater without throwing out the baby. And what I mean by that is that by the bathwater, I mean all the contentious, quasi-political extensions of the basic rights as set out in the 1940s. And I think Stephen's quite right to say that, you know, the Strasbourg Court is activist, and it has extended the reach of the convention far beyond what most people in this country would regard as legitimate, fundamental human rights. And I don't think it's an answer for Jamie to point to the low number of cases where the UK has been taken to Strasbourg, because, of course, the whole point of the Human Rights Act is that the domestic courts here are now fully empowered and indeed expected to apply the Strasbourg jurisprudence. So really, it's only where you have primary legislation that explicitly contradicts an aspect of the convention, where the hands of the domestic courts are tied to merely issuing a declaration of incompatibility, that the only remedy is to go to Strasbourg. But on the other hand, I do think it is a genuine point to say the tyranny of the 51% could eventually reach a situation in which, and I don't think we should be complacent about this, we could very well at some point in the future have an extreme government that does have popular backing and which does wish to seek to infringe what most people would regard as genuinely fundamental human rights. Now, Jamie mentioned that there are only two countries in the world, I think, where human rights aren't entrenched in the constitution, Saudi Arabia and I think somewhere else. But of course, in this country, the problem is we don't have a written constitution. If we just have a so-called British Bill of Rights, that would just have the status of any other Act of Parliament, and an extremist government that could command a majority in Parliament could simply abrogate that to the extent it wished to. So what I'd like to hear from the panel is, are there any ingenious ways in which we can throw out the bathwater without the baby?
Thank you. Can you pass the microphone to your left, please? And then I'll bring the speakers back.
Hi there. I'd just like to say that for Angel, the idea that human beings are essentially rational, I just think is for the birds. All human rights that we have derived on have come from the back of wars and beheaded kings. That's just how it works. It's how the American Revolution happened. It's how we got the Bill of Rights, Magna Carta, habeas corpus. All of it has come off the back of bloodshed to essentially stop monarchs and tyrants taking the piss, right? In the situation that we're in now, Can the entirety of the panel not see how the public, people out in the streets at the moment, the hundreds of thousands out there, they are all concerned that they are still piss takers in this government and in this judiciary, and it's going to come to a stage where it's gone too far and people try something other than the democratic process?
Thank you. I will go back to the audience. We'll take many more questions, but I want to bring the speakers back now. Now, please don't try and answer all of those points because there's a lot, but just pick up one or two points that you're particularly interested in. I'll take you all in this order, so if you could go first, John.
Yes, thank you. So, picking up on the second to last gentleman, I think one of the interesting things in this arena, I would say, that has changed from the late 1940s is the massive expansion in things that governments do. And I think that is one of the real challenges when we talk about how human rights applies today and how we might try and change it. You know, if, for example, you had gone to Churchill and Maxwell Fife and said, in about 45 years, someone's going to bring a case under this to argue whether they, as a prisoner, should have access to IVF on the NHS. Like, they would have thought you were insane. And so I think that is really one of the challenges, that compared with when we wrote these, which, you know, were designed to stop the Gestapo, you have the government being involved in so many more aspects of human life than before, and I think it does present a real challenge, and it's not one I'm going to unpick off the top of my head. The other thing I wanted to loop back to, which was the first point about the US Constitution and freedom of speech, I think that raises one of the interesting things that cuts across a lot of what we've been talking about, because I think it's an interesting one that loops together this idea of whether you want absolute democracy or not. Because I would argue in this country that if you had absolute democracy, it would be hugely detrimental to freedom of speech. As much as we like to be the country of, you know, John Stuart Mill, we are the country of Mary Whitehouse. We are the country that, you know, 30 or 40 years ago you had to apply to the government if you wanted to put a controversial play on. We have rising calls in various communities and activist groups about restricting freedom of speech, whether that's returning effectively to blasphemy laws or whether it's expanding into new you know, areas that we broadly wrap up as the culture wars. And I think if you're in the position of saying we should have absolute democracy and we should have freedom of speech, I think you're making a very bad deal on yourself.
Angel?
Sorry, we've got a mic to share here. Picking up first on the gentleman who used my name, I don't deny that historically the reason that we have been able to protect rights is on the backs of bloodshed and on the backs of monarchs. As I've said, I studied the history of natural right theory. But what you must notice during that is that in the entirety of the Dark Ages, we had about one, maybe two, developments on the field of human rights, the Magna Carta and the British Bill of Rights. In like 600 years, we only had those few protections. This does not mean rights violations stopped or slowed down. In fact, they intensified. What monarchs could do as they pleased, except for those few limits in the UK. What happened then was the Enlightenment. We had the explosion of reason. We had the protection of Enlightenment ideals. Then we have the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the US Constitution and the revolutions and all the rest of it. I'm not saying it doesn't take bloodshed to protect rights or to make us realize that we need them. I'm just saying the philosophic base is reason, and we must use it and protect it in order to protect our rights. On the subject of protecting our rights and democracy, I'm absolutely in agreement with John here. If you leave the tyranny of the majority, they will undermine the minority from time to time. We've been talking about the Holocaust and Hitler without naming it, but that was what the convention was originally designed to protect against, and that was a democracy. The Weimar Constitution didn't protect anybody's rights, and the result was Hitler. The lovely lady in front of me from China was talking about morally defending how we ought to defend Western values, and the answer is morally, proudly, and as often as we can. Speak up on whatever platform you're able, and I think this also goes to the truth about what's going on in China. You're absolutely right. Young people idealize it. I can say that. I'm the youngest on the panel. But whatever platform you're comfortable with, speak up about it. I myself have written some articles about the Chinese censorship of the film industry. So whatever area interests you, this is the great thing about arguing in the battlefield of ideas. We need people everywhere, so whatever you're interested in is what you ought to do. Somebody mentioned not imposing our ideas on other people. This is the great thing about rights. You don't have to agree with me that the Enlightenment is morally superior, but if we are not violating each other's rights, then we're both free to believe that. think that's all.
Stephen.
I'm glad that somebody mentioned the Enlightenment, because it's important that everybody learns that this is a fault line between Aristotle and Plato. So we were in the Dark Ages because we burnt all our copies of Aristotle. And some very clever monks stroke academics from the University of Bologna went to the Emir of Cadiz, an Islamic leader, and said, "Dear Emir, can I borrow your copy of Aristotle?" And very thankfully, that lovely man, thank you, Emir of Cadiz, said yes. They took it back to the University of Bologna. Obviously, it takes ages to hand, you know, copy books. So very slowly, out of the University of Bologna came the Italian Renaissance. And that's why it's always Italian first, because they were the ones who went back to Aristotle first. And then that spreads throughout the West, and we get the Western Renaissance, and we get Western civilization as we know it. Fast forward to the mid-90s, when a bunch of politically left-leaning elites decide, oh, bugger that, we'll go back to Plato. We will go back to the idea of philosopher princes. That's the best way to run society. Oh, and by the way, we'll be the philosopher princes. And we know best. And we're going to take public money and we're going to siphon it off into this thing. The ECHR and Strasbourg are that. You asked me how to stop the baby being thrown out with the bathwater. Well, I don't think that office block can do it. I think that office block needs to go, because it's not redeemable. Our own judges are not used to this process, and they are still largely uncorrupted by it. But I'm using that word very deliberately, because when you ask judges to make political decisions, you do corrupt them. They stop being inside that giant tree, running it and doing it properly and making it efficient, and they go back to, ooh, what do I think? Ooh. And you just ask them questions that they shouldn't be asked. And this is very slowly corrupting them. And given how long it came in, I was very worried when it sort of came in, but it's taken ages. They've been marvellous. The British judiciary are fabulous. But it is corrupting them. So in 2021, we had a case where the judge accepted that there was no ambiguity in the words of the statute. There was no way to read it other than X equals Y. And they used the Human Rights Act to say, nonetheless, X equals Z. That is corrupt power. That is rewriting legislation. That is giving magic power to an elite figure who's not democratically accountable. I mean, that really is the point. I mean, we have one major problem with the office block in Strasbourg, in that because of you, this is the irony, they don't trust you, but I do, because of you, we're the only people who take it seriously. So two of the members of the office block in Strasbourg have just gone to war with each other. Anybody talking about that? No. Have they all got human rights in their constitution? I bet they have. But it doesn't matter, does it? They're all ignoring it. The majority of decisions are ignored. The EU did a report on its own members pointing out three member states in particular who are just outrageous when it comes to ignoring the decisions of the office block in Strasbourg. We follow it. Worse, and I don't like accepting that it has jurisprudence, because jurisprudence is the tree. Jurisprudence is law. That's all it means. It's the process of applying rules in a consistent way. And I don't think it does apply rules in a consistent way. But that's our unique problem with this. And it's the irony is that we follow it, and it's corrupting our system. So get rid of the office block. If you want fundamental rights or not, I mean, John, I just don't think it's the view of a lawyer to tell you whether you want fundamental rights or not. I just don't think it's my job. So I'm not anti-fundamental rights. I'm not pro-fundamental rights. I want to go back to doing my job. I want to go back to making the rules work and making sure that they function efficiently. By the way, there is, just if I'm allowed, very quickly.
Briefly.
This is public money. £750 million goes to that office block in Strasbourg. It doesn't go to legal aid so that normal people can access the courts, does it? Who actually gets to go to the office block in Strasbourg? Is it the ordinary people? No. It's whoever certain entitled elite individuals decide has the best political point they want to make. They get to go to the office block in Strasbourg, and they get to be the token puppets of politics for the day. They get picked up, paraded around, and then they get plonked down. This is a total waste of public money, and it's a disgrace. I trust you to protect my fundamental rights. I don't trust judges.
Thank you. We don't have time for applause at the moment. Jamie.
Stephen, were you describing any of my clients in that moment there? Because I can tell you that they're nothing elite about them, and none of the issues that they're facing are political problems that are somehow being garnered by the elite. They're just very real problems that sometimes politicians
don't solve. And there's a key difference between law and politics that I do think it's important to keep in mind, that you can't always rely on politicians to, you know, pull the finger out and solve a problem. And in the meantime, people suffer quite frequently. And sometimes you need the courts to step into that breach. And sometimes that's all the courts do. They say, we're going to hold a position here until such time as the lawmakers, the legislature, devise a proper system to address a problem. So I'm going to come back to that point in a moment, but it's really important to keep it in mind. There's some really, really intelligent contributions to this debate. And I think the broader question about what type of democracy we want to live in, Stephen is right about. It's not for us to dictate that as lawyers. We all make that decision. We all decide whether or not we want to have a completely untrammeled legislature or untrammeled executive, or whether or not we want to have some checks and balances in place to try and prevent majoritarian rule. That's a discussion everybody in this room is completely qualified to answer. So we can all, you know, have our own respective opinions. I don't want to say much more about it. Can I just make a small piece, though, or explain something about the evolution of the European Convention on Human Rights and what that's actually meant in practice, and why, in my view, it's broadly speaking a good thing. So it's absolutely right that the convention was drawn up at a certain time and place, sort of sociologically, if you like. But of course, we know things do change. And the European Convention of Human Rights has not itself changed unless there's agreement at the Council of Europe, where you have protocols, where everybody decides to add some rights to the convention. So there's a right, for example, in relation to property, or there's a right in relation to education. And those were added as consensus amongst European countries. So that's the first point to understand. That's how the convention has principally changed. Where the judges have added to the convention, as so described, all they're really doing is filling out the rights. And can I just give two very quick examples? So on the question of same-sex relationships, over a piece of about 20 years, the European Convention was repeatedly asked to find it as a matter of right that people in same-sex relationships should enjoy equivalent protection to people who are in not same-sex relationships. And the European Court said no for a very long time, said that's not a right that we recognise. It's a political choice to be made domestically. Until it reached the position that there were just a few outlier countries who weren't doing that. And at that point, the European Court was prepared to say that the consensus, which was evidence-based, wasn't their opinion as individuals, it was evidence-based, was so profound and so strong that there no longer was any justification for a particular state not to respect that right that same-sex couples ought to enjoy equal legal protection. Not necessarily marriage, just equal legal protection. Can I give you one other quick example, which is a live issue now? So people who suffer from autism, as we know, can have very significant behaviours that challenge. They're extremely difficult things to manage, as it were, in society. And generally speaking, how we are doing that at the moment is we put them in hospital and we purport to treat them. But we can't actually treat people with autism. It's not a mental illness. You can't be cured of it. And we have this terrible scenario where we have people with autism stuck in mental health psychiatric wards where they should not be, not being treated for months and months and months and years and years and years. And it's now demonstrably bad for them. The politicians have not worked out how to solve this problem. They have not put the resources in place to do so. So the judges are now starting to be asked by the parents of these poor people who are stuck in these hospitals, can you do anything to solve this situation? Are there any rights here that are relevant? And this is where Article 8 is being used. It is recognised that people are suffering from autism, who are being treated as if they are ill, are not in fact ill, and are basically being detained because we have not come up with a managed way to allow them to live as members of our society. And the courts are only being asked to do that because our politicians have failed to solve the problem. And meantime, people are suffering. There's nothing wrong with that from a democratic perspective, in my view.
And thank you, Jamie. You'll get another chance. that's fine. Luke.
I wanted to pick up on this idea of the tyranny of the 51%. Because whenever I hear people talking about the tyranny of the 51%, I want to ask a few more questions. Like, what would such a tyranny look like? In our context, what would it amount to? A fellow speaker said, well, the Weimar Constitution did not protect rights, result Hitler. I know you didn't mean to put it that simply, but obviously when we face political situations like that, they're far more complicated than, well, we didn't enshrine rights, therefore despotism, therefore tyranny. And in fact, it would be remiss of us to not recognise that tyrannies don't tend to have a great respect for the law anyway. So if we did end up in a tyranny of the 51%, then I don't think a human rights-based constitution would do much to change that. So just push the... Whenever you hear that argument made, I would just push to ask a few more questions. I think accountability and democracy are the two kind of unanswerable points here. And I did not like at all the Rwanda policy. But
I can understand when people in the public say, why is it that a decision made by a judge in Strasbourg in the middle of the night can stop a democratically, on an interim basis, and you know, having reviewed the case on an, you know, without going into the detail, but I think the point is unanswerable that that decision prevented that policy being carried out. And if I'm wrong, Jamie, you can correct me, but that is the I just don't think, and the public see it. The public see that that's happened, and if human, and if we want to carry this framework forward, you have to defend it on the basis that sometimes that judge is right where you are wrong. And I think that's a problem. Why do I think it's a problem? Because I think when it comes to questions of immigration and our borders, it's vital that people feel that they have control. Because it's when people feel that they have control that we can actually start winning arguments. I'm in favour of a more liberal approach to immigration. And what I think we've seen since Brexit is that the more people feel as though they have control, the more relaxed they are about a more open policy. You know, we've seen public attitudes towards immigration soften since the vote for Brexit. And that's a clear example of how the more control people have, the more relaxed they can be about opening up. And that's why I think democratic control is so important. Just on same-sex relationships, that's actually my favourite example of how, in this country, liberalisation of gay relationships happened very late, and it happened as a result of getting the law out of people's lives. It was the result of repealing the Sexual Offences Act, which decriminalised offences like, which criminalised offences like buggery, offences like, you know, things that effectively made same-sex relationships illegal. Homosexuality remained illegal in this country until fairly recently, and it was only a result of removing statutory criminal law that that became a true freedom. The recognition by the European Court, I would argue, was at least secondary to the fact that we stopped people being able to be arrested for living their intimate lives.
Okay, thanks, Luke. A number of people have asked questions about the problem of mission creep. And what I'd like people to think about is whether there is something inherent in the nature of human rights that necessarily leads to that problem of mission creep. The reason why I say that is because human rights are necessarily vague principles which never mandate a particular outcome. So someone spoke about the First Amendment of America and its constitutional defence of free speech. That doesn't mean in America you can say absolutely everything. They do have libel laws, for example, in America, and you're not allowed, you certainly wouldn't be allowed to go on a march and chant "gas the Jews." So none of these principles command or demand a particular outcome. The question, I think, is whether that outcome should be determined by judges, which is what happens when those principles are ratified in a law, or whether it should be determined by politicians who are answerable to the public in a democracy. And that, I think, is one of the issues that gets to the heart of this issue of mission creep and democracy versus too much law. Anyway, plenty of hands, I see. So, gentlemen here, please.
Thanks very much. Jamie, you've twice mentioned the evidence base. And I just wanted to push you on that, because I think it relates to the point that Luke began, made his speech on about actually the ECHR is a bit of a side issue. Why, you know, we're fiddling why Rome burns. So you said that, well, say you take the same-sex relationships. At one point, the ECHR didn't want to get involved, but over time, things became so clear and the evidence base was so clear that they decided that it was okay and time to do that. And on something so, you know, very important, you can have different perspectives on this, it's unclear how there's an evidence base that determines the right outcome. Because it's a question of values, it's a question of the society you want to live in. It doesn't seem how an evidence base can give you the answer. So I it seems to me that that pointing to an evidence base is part of the problem here. It's actually part of the mission creep, where it says that actually people are irrational, people can't really come to a sound decision, so we better do it for them. So I just want you to justify your use of evidence base.
Yep, there's a gentleman behind there with the green shirt. Thank you.
Hello. So,
yes, it's a green wristband. I thought it was a shirt. It's you. You, carry on.
I'm a psychiatrist, and actually I work with people with autism. I just want to point out the reason that what you said is the state of affairs is not because we don't have laws or we need judges, because we have become such a risk-averse profession and society that everybody is too scared that if we discharge this person, What do they do? If they attack someone, what's going to happen? And then we have all these risk assessments that day after day pile up all these incidents. And everybody's too scared. And then they go to a judge. And when the judge says, yeah, discharge, everybody wash their hands. Okay, we all go happy. It's not that because we have no law, we have no laws or we don't respect human rights. It is the risk aversion. I don't think it has much to do with human rights. Although human rights have helped in my profession, that in tribunals a few decades ago, people had to go and prove that they were not detainable. Now, actually, the balance of proof has changed. And as psychiatrists, I have to prove, and I sit on tribunal myself, the authority has to prove that they need to detain someone. But one thing that I have with the whole human rights is that I grew up in Iran, a very ultra-religious society and tyranny, I have to say. And the document seems like a religious text to me, and we have a group like religious clergy who are the judges who have the monopoly of interpreting the text and tell us that this is interpretation. That's it. And it's not take it or leave it. You have to take it. There's nothing against human rights, but this process seems a bit uncomfortable for me. Thank you.
And to your left, please, yeah, gentleman there.
Hello there. I think when someone as serious as Lord Sumption writes in The Spectator that we have to look seriously at what's going on with the court, we should take that seriously. That is a critique of an activist court, and he cites several examples, principally around Article 8. Now, activist courts, I share his concern, I think are undesirable because they're undemocratic, and I think they create brittle rights. It was an activist court that decided Roe v. Wade, and look how that turned out. I fear for gay marriage in the US for precisely that reason. I think it is a mistake for the ECHR, and I speak as a gay rights campaigner, to be lecturing more religious conservative countries about gay marriage years and years and years after it is controversial, because there's no discourse in those countries, there's no popular consensus for gay marriage, it's being imposed from the outside, there's no national discussion, as we had here, as we had in Australia. This is a radically activist court. We have a piece of legislation in this country, the Gender Recognition Act, because of the decision in Goodwin and the United Kingdom. That led directly to the passage of a piece of legislation which many feminist groups downstairs will tell you is hugely problematic, badly drafted, and now results in the so-called Haldane problem and the divisions and the legal mess of so-called legal sex, which is going to go all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now, look, that's not just an activist court getting a case wrong here or there. That's a court saying, you pass this piece of legislation. That's extraordinary, in my view, both in terms of democracy and both in terms of a failure to consult. So I don't know precisely where I am on this in terms of do we leave, don't we leave. I do share some of views of Stephen's expressed. I do think that some of the greatest expressions of human rights come from our domestic courts. Think of Lord Justice Sedley in DPP and Raymond Bate talking about free speech. I think of cases like Harry Miller in the College of Policing and Mr. Justice Knowles talking about we've never had a Stasi, we've never had a Cheka. I don't accept that this country is unable to police its own human rights or constitutional arrangements. I notice that the famous prorogation case was a UK Supreme Court case. It seems to me that we are adequately pitched to settle disputes between governments and between individuals. So as I say, I'm not sure exactly where I am on this, but when someone as serious as Sumption is saying this, I need a bit of convincing, given the activist nature of this court, that it's not all bathwater and no baby.
Thank you. And just to say on that, the examples you gave, the judges specifically said that free speech is protected under human rights law and the English common law. Yeah. Yes. Gentlemen to your left, please.
Sorry, I just think we're ignoring the elephant in the room, briefly alluded to by Luke, which is mass and uncontrolled immigration, not only into this country, but throughout the Western world, and the extent to which the ECHR is acting as a barrier against lawfully elected governments to control their own borders. Would the panel please directly address that issue? Thank you.
Yes, over there, please.
So, Jamie mentioned in his opening comments, might use the word parochialism, and there's been a lot of discussion about checks and balances to protect human rights. Isn't there something at the level of the parish which could also act as a balance? And isn't it true that from freedom of association, solidarity at that level, it's those struggles that have led to us having this sort of law anyway and these sort of constitutions? So I wouldn't be derogatory about the parish in this. I would think about where the law has come from and the circumstances in which it has been developed. The only other thing is I wanted to pick up, Luke, you were saying that we need to look to build political respect for freedoms again. And you then talked about challenging urgent moral problems. I think one of the problems we have is that morality and politics are seen to be completely separate. And what role does this, does the ECHR and this sort of codification, it almost seems to take out these struggles that we've had, you know, with each other, challenging power, and it codifies it, and then it just seems to somehow make it something dead and above us, and there isn't that sort of ongoing sense of activity that we need to do collectively, which really I think is what would keep these things alive.
Okay, can I see? I'm having trouble seeing people at the back, but can you take the microphone to the back, please? We'll take the gentleman on the right and then the gentleman or someone on the left. Sorry, can't see. That side first.
Oh, hello there. I just want to attack this idea of majoritarianism because it seems to be based in a complete lack of political imagination. Firstly, we do not have proportional representation in this country. We do not have a majoritarian system. Instead, we have first past the post, which is regional based, and we have a House of Lords specifically intended to have fundamental rights protected by politically accountable officials. I think fundamentally, the story of history tells us time and time again that if we invest political decision making into judges, it actually undermines the rule of law. Why does it undermine the rule of law? Because if you have a large majority of the public who dislike what judges are doing, what is the way they can get what they want? Well, the only way they can get what they want is not by going, ah, Lord X has done something I don't like, I'm going to vote for an MP to address that. No, they're going to have to attack the entire legal system to actually get what they want. So fundamentally, this idea that we have the ECHR is dangerous, it undermines the entire principles of the judiciary, and it sets up a scenario where the only way that people will get what they want is by voting for majoritarian and authoritarian political parties.
Was someone just by you? Yeah, that hand there. Thank you.
Thank you. I would just like to say, as a Brexiteer, that I and most of us support leaving this court. I mean, it's imposing a tyranny on the elected politicians of this country. It tells them what to do. Is that right? Right, thank you. And by the way, we're not extremists, as I believe we were called. Thank you.
The point is often made that a lot of people, when they voted for Brexit, also thought they were voting to leave the ECHR. There was a hand right at the back. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so I don't think this issue has anything to do with human rights. Human rights are protected under English common law. They are protected in the United Kingdom Human Rights Act. They're protected by the UN. This is about Brexit. This is about our relationship with the EU. I believe that we should have a referendum on whether or not we should leave the ECHR. We had Brexit. We voted to leave the EU. We are now ruled by EU law, even though we're not a member of the EU. This makes absolutely no sense, as it is about sovereignty. And by the way, look at the mass immigration. Hundreds of thousands of migrants coming in illegally across the years, and we have absolutely no power to defend ourselves against this mass invasion because of this EU law that we're no longer a member of.
Yeah. I think I saw some further hands at the back. Yes, lady there.
Yeah, hello. I'm very pro-referendum, so I'd quite like a referendum. Because we're having this debate here, and I don't know whether we should come out of the European Convention or not, but because I don't know enough about it. Because what we've heard today are things like, oh, well, there's only 200 or so that have gone to court. But that's quite disingenuous, because actually, the whole thing is embedded in our law, so it doesn't get up to the top unless there's a major problem. And I think most people don't realise that. They only hear about the big cases. They don't know that a social worker taking a child into care has to look at things like the abusive parent's right to family life. They don't realise that it's not just about individual rights, that organisations can say, I need to be protected, and Kent County Council, for example, takes the coroner to court at an inquest because they don't want to be blamed for a child's death. And I don't think people realise it's that wide. So, and as the gentleman further down said, the issue of the moment is how it's being used with immigration law. And I don't know enough about that either. So I would say that until we need to have a proper debate about all the issues, not just what is like a political hot potato at the moment, because it is so deeply embedded in our society and the issues are so important. Human rights are important, so we do need to debate it.
I suppose one way of looking at the ECHR is to ask the question, is the problem with the E or is the problem with the HR?
Or the C.
Or the whole lot. So, I think there were some more hands. I'll bring the speakers back shortly for their concluding remarks. Are there some more questions? Yeah, right at the back, please.
Hiya. Can you hear me?
Yep.
I was wondering how you would navigate exit from the ECHR with our existing obligations in international law. So, for example, it underpins the trade and cooperation agreement. So, be interested to hear your views on that.
I thought you were also going to mention the Belfast Agreement, because it is also baked into that.
But that text,
which is audio. Yes, I mean that might be a session in its own right. But anyway, the question is there. Should the panel want to try and answer it? So, are there some more questions? No? All right. Well, I'll bring the speakers back for 2.5 minutes each, and I'll take them in reverse order from the way that they spoke originally. So, starting with you, please, Luke.
Sorry, I'm completely unprepared. I should have been prepared. I wanted to pick up this point about, in a previous life, I worked with adults with autism, adults with very serious autistic spectrum disorders. And one thing, I have a lot of friends who still work in that area, and one thing I ask them what they think about human rights. And of course, their interaction with human rights tends to be bureaucracy, because effectively they see human rights as a curb on their judgment about how to deal with a particular situation and with a particular patient. I suppose sometimes that curb could be a good thing. But generally, I think individuals who work directly with people are in a better position to judge what's best for them in general than anyone else, including lawyers, including judges, including tribunals. And I'd love to do a little bit more academic work on the impact of that layer of bureaucracy that human rights introduces. It's a big topic. I don't have time to answer it now. But I'd like to finish with just a call, because John mentioned, well, do we have any such thing as universal values? Is there any such thing as moral principles anymore? I think there are. I think they can be democratically decided and they can be democratically protected. I'd point to tolerance, freedom of speech, democracy, freedom of association. All of these things are vulnerable. All of these things are subject to change, attack, and shift. The most reliable protection for them are democracy and accountability. We needn't think that merely because we codify something, because we write it down in a purportedly enforceable legal document that those things are protected forever. The job of protecting them falls to us. And if we take one lesson from the last 2 weeks, it's that that lesson has to be relearned, and these freedoms have to be fought for time and time again. Thank you.
Thank you, Luke. Okay, I'm not going to stop you clapping. Not this time. Angelica, please.
Thank you. I think the fundamental issue we need to realize when it comes to democracy is that people look at it as we're giving people control. You're not. You're giving the majority control. If we want people to be able to run their own lives, we need to give individuals the ability to run their own lives. And that's what individual rights are all about. When it comes to borders, I am an immigrant. So obviously I'm pro-immigration, but beyond that, I think this is also a rights issue. People should be able to decide where they live as long as they are not infringing on property rights. Now, that is not to dispute the fact that the UK and many other countries have set up perverse incentives for immigration. If you come here as an immigrant, from an asylum seeker, you have all kinds of perks at the expense of the British taxpayer. That's one conversation. The idea of people simply moving here is another. Luke mentioned I was not as precise as I could have been regarding the Weimar Constitution. Of course, tyrants disregard laws and constitutions, and there was a serious culture that did not respect individual rights in that context. But when you don't have any kind of protection, you just leave the door wide open for those tyrants rather than putting something against them. To finish up, I would just say, when we put politicians in a position to protect our rights, they're not interested. We can call them democratically accountable all we like. They're accountable, again, to the majority. They will play to what they think is most popular, and this is why we have the rise of populism. This is how populist governments in Latin America have been elected. This is how Donald Trump was elected. So we must be aware that politicians are primarily out for their own power. We must be instead trying to give the power to the individual, and I think that also relates to the issue of the risk-averse society, where we value safety over individual freedom.
Thank you. Jamie, please.
Well, I think just reflecting, there's actually quite a lot of agreement on the panel, and I suspect ultimately there really is in the room as well. So I'm just going to try and address some of the sort of more discrete points that have cropped up. I don't want to be seen to be dodging the question about Rwanda and immigration, first and foremost. But I'm going to try and answer this by also answering the gentleman's question about evidence-based here. So what actually happened with Rwanda is, you know, deportations happened quite suddenly, okay? So deportations were proposed to Rwanda, and a legal challenge was brought on the premise that there wasn't sufficient evidence to demonstrate that it was safe to send people to Rwanda, despite what the Rwandan government was saying. Because the last time Rwanda agreed this sort of deal, they did it with Israel, and they breached it repeatedly. And of course, there were victims of those breaches. There were people who were sent back to the countries they came from without their asylum applications being dealt with, or subjected to conditions in Rwanda that objectively met the standards of human treatment. And all that happened was, when that case was issued, initially, the High Court was asked not to allow anybody to be sent to Rwanda until those legal issues had been resolved. And it's true to say that the English court at first instance said, we're not going to do that. We're going to allow those flights to take place on the premise that these people can be brought back. It was only one plane load. Then what happened is, one lawyer did make an application to the European Court on what's called the emergency measures principle, which is just a recommendation from the European Court, who said, well, there does seem to be a credible argument here based on what happened last time with Israel, so we're going to recommend that the UK government doesn't send anyone until the legal issues are resolved. And the UK government agreed to do that. So the UK government then effectively agreed with the Strasbourg court that it wouldn't send anybody to Rwanda until the legal issues were resolved. Then they were resolved by a domestic court who simply asked the question, is there sufficient evidence to justify the conclusion that it would be safe to send people to Rwanda at the moment, based on the evidence that's available? And the court did what courts do. They reviewed the evidence. And they understood that they had to give the government a huge amount of leeway and discretion to reach its own judgment, but nevertheless ultimately concluded that there was insufficient evidence. Now, I think that's a good thing. I think that kind of check and balance on what might otherwise be bad policy is a good thing in an unqualified way. But to answer the gentleman's question, what about when you're actually answering values? Well, yes, it's true that sometimes it's just looking for consensus. There may not be an evidence base, as it were, to support a value judgment. But when you've got this position where, on a question of discrimination, there isn't any other reason
for the discrimination, the difference in treatment, other than prejudice, then at some point the European Court is prepared to say the consensus in a value sense is so strong that we will find that as part of the rights. And again, I think that's a good thing. My final point, if I may, then. The question about the parish, that was a brilliant, brilliant question, if I may say, so I'm not sure if the question is actually still here. I entirely agree with this idea that we need to make rights feel like there are rights, and there has been a problem with implementation in this country. It has become an elite project. We didn't do enough when we introduced the Human Rights Act to make people realise it's our rights we're trying to protect, and we've sort of been fighting a rearguard battle ever since. So I really would encourage everybody to recognise that even if that is the case, there is a legitimate reason to believe, ultimately, that these rights are here to protect all of us. And who knows who's going to be next in needing to rely on these rights to protect us? It could be anyone in this room. And when that happens, believe you me, you then realise the value of these things. And whilst you're not in that position, please be very, very wary of criticising lawyers who defend people in difficult positions. It's not all politically motivated. Sometimes it literally is just about helping somebody in need who's in front of you. And the only way you can do that is by relying on the Human Rights Act. And that's why it's a powerful tool.
Thank you, Jamie. And just on that last point, there is a session after lunch on Is the Law Partisan, which will be addressing some of those issues. Stephen, your final thoughts, please.
Set me free. Set law free. Let us go back to doing law. We don't do politics well. The office block in Strasbourg is a total joke. It's a disgrace. It's got mission creep because it's an office block in Strasbourg that needs to justify its existence. It's declared that the convention is a living document, which in law is an abomination. It just means that they can wave their hands and say it means whatever they say it means. That's a joke. Please, I trust the people of this room. I'm bisexual. If I get a boyfriend, I mean, it's unlikely as I slip further into middle age, but, you know, if it does happen and I'm here with my boyfriend, it's going to be because you people will tolerate us and be kind and be nice and no one will say something mean. It's got nothing to do with an office block in Strasbourg. It really irritates me how they sort of, they grab that one. That gentleman over there spoke very passionately about migration and he's absolutely right. That gentleman over there warned us because I'm inside Versailles. Okay, I'm with the nut jobs who think that they're philosopher princes and this is going to last forever. I'm inside the palace and we're turning up the music so that we can ignore the mob. But as these problems get worse, and Dennis used the word brittle, as society gets more brittle, one day people are going to come to Versailles with torches and I don't want that to happen. So set me free, let me just live in my law library, doing law, making our legal system the best in the world, deal with the politics outside. That's what I ask. Thank you.
Thank you. John, your final thoughts, please.
So the first thing I wanted to just briefly touch on the migration point. Most of the rise in migration has nothing to do with people bringing human rights cases. It's the politicians don't actually want to do it. Yeah. And so that is a separate issue. I also wanted to pick up on the final point about international obligations. That is a really important thing when it comes to, do we get rid of it? How do we disentangle ourselves? For example, if we do that, are foreign countries going to still extradite people to us as readily? Probably not. Are they going to share information with us? For example, some of the European networks we're involved in about sharing information about people who access child sexual exploitation material from service on the continent. Are they going to share it? Are they going to carry on sharing with us? We don't know. And we had a lot of those debates in Brexit where the people in favour said, yeah, the good stuff's going to keep happening. And then we got past the point and actually we found a lot of that was still up for discussion. And finally, I think this idea of the tyranny of the 50% plus one has got over-egged a bit. At the moment, there are countless ways in which the government may decide to do something that affects your individual rights. They may decide to knock your house down to build a railway through it. At the moment, you can use things like human rights to help you in that. Over the last sort of few decades, we have seen the government do that in all sorts of ways, and the Human Rights Act and the ECHR be a shield against that. So, you know, I think I'd be very careful of getting rid of things that you think protect other people because you may not find them there when they come to protect you.
Thank you. Before we thank all the speakers, can I just make some announcements about the next hour and a quarter, which is lunchtime? But there are plenty of things going on. So, for example, there are book signings at the bookshop, which I think is on the first floor. And there will be book signings from Remy Adekeo, Laura Dodsworth and Raki Ishan. There's also refreshments for sale in the Bishop Partridge Hall on the first floor, and there's also a series of lunchtime bites. That's debates, bites, debates, starting in 15 minutes. So thank you all very much for attending, and could we please thank our speakers.